Babylon is located, the ruins of Babylon is located on the banks of the Euphrates River, about 55 miles directly south of modern-day Baghdad. It's in Iraq, and it's interestingly, three of the cities that we have talked about, Babel of old, which was in some locale of Mesopotamia, Nineveh, which we looked at last week, which would be the ruins in northern Iraq, and here this little further south in that part of the world, the city of Babylon. We oftentimes in our minds, and because of its similarities and the similarities of geography, confuse Babel and Babylon. Babel was the early city, and it certainly was in that same place, and in some ways Babylon was sort of a recreation of that earlier city and its empire and its strength, but certainly those are in different time frames of human history. If you travel to the ruins of Babylon today, it doesn't look like it looked back in the 1930s. It looks something like you see now. Because the Iraqis, particularly under Saddam Hussein, as we saw also in Nineveh, as we also saw at the Mesopotamian ziggurat that we sometimes associate, at least in kind, with the Tower of Babel and the city of Babel, they decided that they would rebuild them. And part of the thought was, look how many people flock from all over the world to see the great pyramids in Egypt. So if we could rebuild these ruins and have these magnificent structures, people will come from all over the world to see this great place. Also, you may or may not know that there was probably a little more of a egocentric desire to rebuild these ruins into a city that you could visit, basically to be an archaeological theme park, if you will, that you could go on vacation and see these things, was because Saddam Hussein fancied himself, in some sense, as the reincarnation of Nebuchadnezzar of old. And one of his desires, and I think this factored into his thinking, that's why I think led him to the first war with Iran and the invasion of Kuwait and so forth, because in the mindset of a reconstituted Babylonian empire, a reconstituted Nebuchadnezzar, he wanted to extend his empire and his influence and his power and so forth. So that's what you would see today. But interestingly, it was not completed. They're just hollow buildings and places you could go there and visit. Some of these were damaged during the most recent war in Iraq, and the United States and the military men caught a lot of grief from that because of one of the things they did. They bulldozed a section of it to create a helicopter landing pad, and the archaeologists went crazy because, you know, you're disturbing all the rocks and stuff underneath. But nonetheless, that is what is there now. One of the most interesting finds, if you bring up the next slide, was called the Ishtar Gate. This was excavated back also in 1930. I think that picture was taken either 1932 or 33, something like that. But the Ishtar Gate was a magnificent ceremonial memorial structure that one of the main gates into ancient Babylon. And its foundations were unearthed. And if, in fact, you can see some of the images of these animals in the relief of the walls. And one of the things that's interesting about this gate, there was found an inscription from Nebuchadnezzar that described the building of this. So not only do we have the ruins and the remains, we also have a first-person account from history about what he built. This will give you some flavor of what this inscription was. Of course, it's been translated. Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, the faithful prince, appointed by the will of Marduk, one of their gods, the highest of princely princes, beloved of Nebu, a prudent counselor, who has learned to embrace wisdom and fathom their divine being and reveres their majesty. He kind of had some eye trouble, I think you would say. He goes on to talk about his how he rebuilt this gate. In particular, with this particular gate, he says, "Therefore, I had them made of bricks with blue stone, on which wonderful bulls and dragons were depicted. I covered their roofs by laying majestic cedars lengthwise over them. I hung doors of cedar adorned with bronze at all the gate openings. I placed wild bulls and ferocious dragons in the gateways and thus adorned them with luxurious splendor so that people might gaze on them in wonder." So he built a city that was designed to inspire awe. It was actually a German team that excavated this in the 30s, and interestingly, this would never pass modern political correctness in today's world. But what the Germans did, everything they excavated of value, they took back to Germany. And now if you go to a particular museum in Berlin, you will see this picture. This is the rebuilt Ishtar Gate, using as much of the original material as they could get their hands on to reconstruct the Ishtar Gate. And they used a particular type of tile, and you see it was blue and how those animals are depicted there. And if you want to go online, you can see a lot more detailed pictures of both the inside and the outside of this. And even the scale of this, and you can see how it's quite impressive. This, as best we can tell, is still a reduced scale of the original. Here's a computer model of the, or I shouldn't say a computer model, it's an actual model. One of the interesting things, and you have no doubt heard, have you ever heard of the Hanging Gardens of Babylon? It was one of the seven wonders of the world. This is a computer-generated artist conception of the Hanging Gardens. No one knows exactly what it looked like. One of the reasons is there has been no archaeological discovery that says this is what this was. There are several historical references to it by Greek and such as the Greek historians that in of a later era depicted them. And the story goes like this. Nebuchadnezzar had multiple wives, and part of the political scene was to marry wives from other kingdoms to forge alliances. One of his wives in his harem was from a very mountainous region, and of course this is a very flat plain there where the Euphrates cuts through. And she was lonely and she was homesick, so what Nebuchadnezzar sought to do was to make an artificial mountain for her. And the descriptions are that Nebuchadnezzar had an irrigation system that would pump water to the top of this large mountain-like structure, and the water would flow down and would water these lavish gardens and all of its beauty and all of its lushness, so that one of his queens could feel at home. And the ancients had loved to make these lists about the great wonders of the world, and this, along with the pyramids of Egypt and so forth, was considered one of the wonders, the seven wonders of the ancient world. There is a lot of debate in modern times whether it actually existed or not. It's not mentioned in the Bible. It's just mentioned in secular history. But nonetheless, it says something about this, the magnificence of this city. Let me just read you a brief description. The Greek historian Herodotus writes this about Babylon as he described it. He described Babylon as encompassing behind walls 196 square miles. The wall circumference around the outside he described as being 56 miles in circumference. He described that outside of that wall was a 30-foot wide moat all the way around the city. He described it as having double walls, and this will be important to our discussion just a bit later when we get into the Bible. But he described the outer wall, and according to his calculations, again, this isn't in the Bible, so how accurate it is, I cannot guarantee. But he described the outer wall being about 300 feet tall, about the size of a 30-story building. Modern historians think that maybe he exaggerated, but nonetheless, he described them very large. He described them as being 87 feet wide. In other words, eight chariots could ride side by side on the top of this wall all the way around the city. It is described of having 100 gates, and the gates were made of solid brass. And around all these walls were 250 watchtowers, each of them described as being 100 feet higher than the outer wall. It was a large and impressive city, to say the least. It was also a very religious city. He describes it as having, stand by for the list, 53 temples of the chief gods, 55 chapels of Marduk, which we saw in that inscription a moment ago. There were 300 chapels for earthly deities. There were 600 chapels for heavenly deities, 180 altars for the goddess Ishtar, the Ishtar Gate we just saw, and Nergal and Adad, 12 others for different gods. And the great temple of the city was the temple of Marduk, which its circumference was 500 by 600 yards wide. So it was religious, but also we understand it was a very pagan city. Well, let's look into the background as we find it in the Bible. That's just some interesting extra-biblical data. 2 Chronicles 36. Here we have the story of Babylon attacking and destroying Judah. This is the beginning of that Babylonian captivity that we spoke of this morning. It says in verse 11, 2 Chronicles 36, Zedekiah, this was the king, the then king of Judah, was 21 years old when he became king, and he reigned 11 years in Jerusalem. He did evil in the sight of the Lord his God, and did not humble himself before Jeremiah the prophet, who spoke from the mouth of the Lord. He also rebelled against King Nebuchadnezzar, who had made him swear an oath by God, and he stiffened his neck and hardened his heart against turning to the Lord God of Israel. Moreover, all the leaders of the priests and the people transgressed more and more according to all the abominations of the nation, and defiled the house of the Lord which he had consecrated in Jerusalem. So the writer of the Chronicles here is laying out the justification for what God is about to allow to have happen. Verse 15. And the Lord God of the fathers sent warnings to them by his messengers, rising up early and sending them, because he had compassion on his people and on his dwelling place. But they mocked the messengers of God, despised his words, and scoffed at his prophets, until the wrath of the Lord rose against them, against his people, till there was no remedy. What a chilling phrase to say. No more remedy. Therefore he brought against them the king of the Chaldeans. Chaldeans, just another term for the Babylonians, same people group, who killed their young men with the sword in the house of their sanctuary, and had no compassion on young man or virgin or the aged or the weak. He gave them all into his hands. Now, verse 18 is important for something we're going to see a little bit later, so listen carefully. And all the articles from the house of God, great and small, the treasures of the house of the Lord, and the treasures of the king and of his leaders, all these he took to Babylon. Then they burned the house of God, broke down the wall of Jerusalem, burned all of its palaces with fire, and destroyed all its precious possessions. And all those who escaped with the sword he carried away to Babylon, where they became servants to him and his sons until the rule of the kingdom of Persia. That's important for our study later as well. To fulfill the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah, until the land had enjoyed her Sabbaths. As long as she lay desolate, she kept Sabbath to fulfill 70 years. So that's where we encounter Babylon in its strength. They were used of God, and Nebuchadnezzar was used of God to destroy Jerusalem and carry away not only these precious possessions, even the articles from the temple of God, but to carry away and deport the people. That's how Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego wind up in the book of Daniel over in the kingdom of Babylon. He plundered their people, he plundered their possessions, and Jerusalem lies in ruins to fulfill these unfulfilled Sabbaths, if you will, for 70 years. So we see it was a place of strength. It was victorious over Judah. It was a people of great strength. Now we're going to go to Daniel, and we're going to spend the bulk of our time for the rest of our study in the book of Daniel. So if you will make your way over there, I'll give you just a moment to catch up. We're going to just land briefly in Daniel chapter 3 and briefly in chapter 4, and then we will bore down into the story of Babylon as it is depicted in chapter 4. In chapter 3, we have the story of this image of gold. And the whole thing was that no one was to worship anything, and whenever the music started playing, that everybody had to worship this golden image. Well, that caused a problem for these Jewish captives who only were worshiping and only would worship the one true living God, the God that they served. Verses 8 and 9 tell us that certain of the Babylonians, the Chaldeans, came forward and accused the Jews. And they spoke and said, King Nebuchadnezzar, O live forever. And they talk about the decree and all that sort of thing. Verse 19, very familiar story, you know it well. Then Nebuchadnezzar was full of fury, and the expression of his face changed toward Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He spoke and commanded that they heat the furnace 7 times more than it was usually heated. And he commanded certain mighty men of valor who were in his army to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and to cast them into the burning fiery furnace. He chose the best and the strongest and the bravest for a suicide mission, basically. Verse 21, it says, And these men were bound in their coats, their trousers, their turbans, and their other garments, and they were cast into the midst of the fiery furnace. Therefore, because the king's command was urgent, and the furnace exceedingly hot, the flame of the fire killed those men who took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And these 3 men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell down bound into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. And then God shows up. God shows up to give a warning to this proud king. He shows up to teach him a lesson. Nebuchadnezzar was unaware that the reason he defeated Judah was not because he was the stronger nation. It wasn't just like, well, Assyria took out Israel, we'll take out Judah. Everybody else is, it's because we are strong and we have our military might. He didn't realize that God was using him as a tool in his hand to further out his plan with his people. Verse 24. Then King Nebuchadnezzar was astonished, and he rose in haste and spoke, saying to his counselors, "Did not we cast three men bound into the midst of the fire?" They answered and said to the king, "True, O king." "Look," he answered, "I see four men loose walking in the midst of the fire." Interesting, they were all tied up a moment ago. It says that they were bound in their normal work clothes. And he says, "I see them loose." Isn't it interesting? The only thing that burned was the ropes that bound them. And they're set free. He says, "I see them loose and walking in the midst of the fire, and they are not hurt." And then this last phrase of verse 25, "And the form of the fourth is like the Son of God." They weren't in the fiery furnace alone, but God, in the person here he describes as the Son of God, was with them. And he for this brief moment at least, Nebuchadnezzar is humbled. And it says in verse 29, after it's all over, he says, "Therefore I make a decree that any people, nation, or language which speaks anything amiss against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be cut in pieces, and their houses shall be made an ash heap, because there is no other God who can deliver like this." And the king promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the province of Babylon. So not only were they victorious in God's hands, but they were a proud people. They were a proud people, and you see how God begins a process of at least trying to bring some humility to this proud king. He comes close. He says, "There's no other God like this God that's able to do what this God does." Where he stopped short was recognizing that there is really only one God. He was just saying their God is a little higher than all the other gods, and they had this hierarchy, and so he at least comes close. Then Nebuchadnezzar has another story that unfolds in chapter 4. Now, the stories of Daniel that you read aren't necessarily in a strict chronology. That is not the point of the book of Daniel. The book of Daniel is designed to bring together these stories to take us along a theme of proving that God is God. In spite of the fact that Judah is in captivity, Jerusalem is destroyed, his people are held as slaves, Daniel's message is this: God is still the God who's in charge. Just because his people are going through this time of punishment and chastening does not mean that God has let them down. So it is a vindication of the unique supremacy of God depicted in these events that transpire within the context of their Babylonian experience. In chapter 4, he has this dream. Daniel is called in to interpret it. I don't want to get into all about it because it's rather involved. But I want you to see what happens after this encounter with God. And God reveals some very important truths to him and really warns him what is going to be happening to him. And then it unfolds beginning in verse 28. "All this came upon King Nebuchadnezzar at the end of 12 months." That's 12 months after the warning given in the first 27 verses of this chapter. "At the end of 12 months, he was walking about the royal palace of Babylon. The king spoke, saying," quote, now I want you to listen carefully to this quote and see if you can figure out what's wrong with what he's saying. It's painfully obvious. "The king spoke, saying, 'Is not this great Babylon that I have built for a royal dwelling by my mighty power and for the honor of my majesty?'" Could I translate that into just common vernacular of our day? He's saying, "Aren't I something? Look at what I have done. I am just, no one compares to me." Verse 31. "While the word was still in the king's mouth," he hadn't even finished the sentence, "a voice fell from heaven, 'King Nebuchadnezzar, to you it is spoken. The kingdom has departed from you.' And they shall drive you from men, and your dwelling shall be with the beast of the field. They shall make you eat grass like oxen, and seven times shall pass over you, until you know that the Most High rules in the kingdom of men and gives it to whomever he chooses. In other words, he's saying, you're not king over Babylon because you're special. You're king over Babylon because I have allowed it and I have dictated it. That very hour, the word was fulfilled concerning Nebuchadnezzar. He was driven from men and ate grass like oxen. His body was wet with the dew of heaven, till his hair had grown like eagle's feathers and his nails like bird claws. Let me tell you, that's a step down when you're the king of the whole scene. Suddenly, he starts acting like a beast. Like an animal. He's down on all fours, munching grass like an ox would. And his hair is grown long and matted and looks like bird's feathers. That's how he's described here. And nails like claws. Suddenly he doesn't have the spirit of a man anymore. He has the spirit of an animal. It says, till seven times pass over. There's some debate if that means 7 years or 7 months. We really, you could debate it back and forth. But it's a long period of time, nonetheless, that God humbles him. At the end of the time, verse 34... Interesting now, these next verses are penned in the first person by Nebuchadnezzar. Here this pagan king is used by God to write part of God's word. Part of the inspired text comes from the mouth of this man. At the end of the time, I, Nebuchadnezzar, lifted up my eyes to heaven, and my understanding returned to me. And I blessed the Most High and praised and honored him who lives forever. This is a pretty good theology from a pagan king over this Mesopotamian empire of Babylon. For his dominion is an everlasting dominion. You know, we could all say amen to that. He got that right. And his kingdom is from generation to generation. All the inhabitants of earth are reputed as nothing. That includes kings of Babylon. Compared to God, we're zip. We're nothing. He does according to his will in the army of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth. No one can restrain his hand or say to him, what have you done? That's good theology too. Not one of us has the right to say, Lord, did you make a mistake? What have you done? Did you err? Why do you have the right to do this? Why? Because he's God. That's why. At the same time, my reason returned to me, verse 36. And for the glory of my kingdom, my honor and splendor returned to me. My counselors, my nobles resorted to me. I was restored to my kingdom, and excellent majesty was added to me. Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and extol and honor the King of heaven, all of whose works are truth and his ways justice, and those who walk in pride he is able to put down. Now, Nebuchadnezzar got it. He got this warning of chapter 4. Unfortunately for Babylon, that warning did not pass down a little bit further. We don't know how long it is, but when chapter 5 opens up, we have this story of the king Belshazzar. Now, Belshazzar is a descendant of Nebuchadnezzar, and... We will see that a little bit later. But it's later in history, but another encounter. And it goes right in harmony with what has just occurred in chapter 4, that God is able to humble. Well, let's find out what happens when someone is humbled and praises God. He was restored. What happens when someone refuses to be humbled to God? What's the outcome of, what's that look like? That's chapter 5. That's chapter 5. And this leads us to our lessons for tonight. And there's just four very simple lessons that we want to talk about. The first one is this. Lesson number one, don't overestimate your own strength. Don't overestimate your own strength. That's what happens in chapter 5. And we just want to tell this story again and look at it with a little bit of detail to be reminded, because this is the final chapter of Babylon's history. This is where the kingdom of Babylon ends. This is where the city of Babylon falls. Now, the city continues to be inhabited by the Medes and Persians who overtake it. But in its national empire structure, Babylon vanishes at this juncture. They are defeated. And it's all told in chapter 5. Belshazzar, the king, made a great feast for thousands of his lords and drank wine in the presence of the thousand. Having a big feast, 1,000 people. I mean, that's a pretty impressive feast, to feed 1,000 people and have this great feast. Now, there's a little backstory here we need to put in place. We know this because what happens at the end of the story, so we can now bring it back, so we can put into place what's going on. We know because this is the night that Babylon falls. History tells us that the Persian army, the Persian Empire, which was now in ascension, first it was Assyria, Babylon kind of replaces the Assyrian Empire, then the Medo-Persian Empire comes and takes over Babylon and so forth, and that's followed by the Greek Empire and the Romans, and you know how history unfolds after that, these Gentile world powers. So when he's having this feast outside of Babylon, outside of the walls, there's a great invading army surrounding the city. But Belshazzar feels so secure and so strong and probably so prideful, as we'll see in just a moment, that he is not worried. Let the party continue. This, we would assume, is probably was one of their normal feasts or holidays, something like that. And he just goes on with it. And part of what he's trying to demonstrate to his kingdom is this. I'm not worried about those folks out there. I'm not worried about that invading army out there. See, everything is fine. Eat, drink, and be merry. That's basically the theme of this party. Excuse me. Now, remember what I told you about these walls, these big high walls and all the gates and all of that? It was a city not only that was well fortified and had great defensive structures. History tells us that they maintained, in the days of Nebuchadnezzar at least, and we assume it followed over to Belshazzar's time, that the king decided that they would keep stored up in the city enough provisions to last for 20 years of a siege outside the city. In other words, to have enough grain, enough food, enough animals, enough stuff stored away that all we have to do, if an army comes, we just lock the gates and we're safe inside the walls and we will outlast the invading armies outside. We can maintain. That's what they at least claimed they could maintain for 20 years. The only other thing you needed, if you were going to maintain a city that was laid siege by a surrounding army, and you know how siege warfare worked. Basically, we cut off a city. There's no way in, there's no way out, and we just wait till the people inside get so hungry and weak that when they're demoralized, then we'll start bashing in the cities and the gates and the walls, and then we'll take the city. So it was a waiting game. But the one thing you absolutely needed was fresh water. I mean, you need water more than you need food in the short run. So they were very ingenious of how this worked. They built on both sides the city of Babylon. The ruins testify to this today. The city of Babylon was built on both sides of the Euphrates River. And the wall surrounded the city, and the wall went right across the river. So that the river, the Euphrates River, flowed up to one wall of Babylon. It flowed under the wall, right through the city, and out the other side. So that they had a whole river of fresh water, and it was walled up so people couldn't get under. I mean, maybe a strong man could swim under it, but you couldn't get an army through there that would make any difference. So they were very, very secure. They had water. They had food. They had walls. They had everything they needed. So what's happening in chapter 5, verse 1? Belshazzar says, let's have a party. Let's prove that everything is fine. Verse 2. Here's where he begins to overestimate his own strength. While he tasted the wine, Belshazzar gave the command to bring, notice what he asked for, the gold and silver vessels which his father, Nebuchadnezzar, had taken from the temple which had been in Jerusalem. And the king and his lords, his wives, and his concubines might drink from them. And they brought the gold vessels that had been taken from the temple of the house of God which had been in Jerusalem. And the king and his lords, his wives, and his concubines drank from them. Now that would be bad enough. But notice what it says in verse 4. They drank wine and praised the gods of gold and silver and bronze and iron, wood and stone. Now it wasn't just possessions they were praising, but the God of wood and iron and stone and so forth, that's what they were counting on to protect them. The stone walls and the brass and the iron of their instruments and their gates. In other words, we're going to raise a toast and salute the gods that have provided us all of these defenses. We have nothing to fear. Now, why do you suppose he asked for the stuff from the temple in Jerusalem? There's a particular reason for that. There's a particular reason for that, because it was the Hebrew prophets, particularly a man named Isaiah, and you might just jot in your notes, you can read this at your leisure, but jot down Isaiah 13 and chapter 14. In Isaiah chapter 13 and 14, this is before the Babylonian captivity ensued, Isaiah had prophesied that the day would come when Babylon would be destroyed. It would be overthrown. It would be completely gone from the pages of history. So, we're trusting in all these things to protect us. He's overestimated his own strength. We have everything we need. We're totally protected. We have food. We have water. We have walls. The only people that said we're going to fall was the Hebrew prophets. Let's bring the stuff from their temple, and we will show them and their God a thing or two. So they raise a toast, these holy things that God had reserved and had sanctified and separated for holy use. Not only are they in this probably it was not could we say it this way? This was not a family-friendly scene that was going on at this party to begin with. But then they're praising these false gods. It's despicable. What was going on? Belshazzar was saying, we are strong. Always, 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 always will we get in trouble if we overestimate our own strength. Secondly, don't underestimate God's strength. Don't underestimate God's strength. Verse 5. The party is about to take a turn. In the same hour, the fingers of a man's hand appeared and wrote opposite the lampstand on the plaster of the wall of the king's palace. And the king saw the part of the hand that wrote. And the king's countenance changed. His thoughts troubled him so that the joints of his hips were loosened and his knees knocked against each other. He was scared to death, is how we would say it. There's no body there. There's no figure there. Just the fingers of a man's hand appears and starts writing words on the wall. Isn't it interesting how God arranged this? It's in some way in relation to this lampstand. So God kind of like wherever the kind of the spotlight's shining, that's where God decides to write it so everyone can see it. And notice what he wrote on. I mean, God could have written on the floor, couldn't he? He could have written on the table. He could have written on the back of Nebuchadnezzar's hand. He could have written it in the air. Notice what he wrote it on? He wrote it on the wall. You think you have enough walls? You think you have enough strength? This is what you're trusting in? You're praising the gods that you think helped build all this? Let me just send you a little message. Let me send you a little clue, Belshazzar. And there he writes. And he is terrified. He is terrified. Verse 7. The king cried aloud to bring in the astrologers, the Chaldeans, and the soothsayers. And the king spoke, saying to the wise men of Babylon, whoever reads this is going to get rich, going to be the ruler. We all know that's not going to work. And then we find out later that in verse 10, said the queen, because of the words of the king and his lords, came to the banquet hall. The queen spoke, saying, O king, live forever. By the way, I don't think she's going to get her wish, if you know the rest of the story. Do you not let your thoughts trouble you, nor let your countenance change. There is a man in your kingdom, in whom is the spirit of a holy God. In the days of your father, light and understanding and wisdom, like the wisdom of the gods, were found in him. And King Nebuchadnezzar, your father the king, made him chief of the magicians, astrologers, Chaldeans, and soothsayers. Insomuch as an excellent spirit, knowledge, understanding, interpreting dreams, solving riddles, and explaining enigmas were found in Daniel, whom the king named Belteshazzar. Now let Daniel be called, and he will give the interpretation. So once again, Daniel's brought in to give the answer, which he does. And basically, in these next few verses, Daniel says, you keep your gifts for yourself, give them to somebody else. I'm not interested, but I want you to know that this message that you're about to receive is not coming through man. It is coming from God. Verse 22, we'll pick it up there. He talks, by the way, he mentions the fact that Nebuchadnezzar was humbled and became like an animal and so forth, and how he was lifted up with pride and God brought him down. That message you didn't get. Verse 22, but you, his son Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, although you knew all this. You knew about your father's humbling. And you have lifted yourself up against the Lord of heaven. They have brought the vessels of the house of his house before you, and your lords, your wives, your concubines have drunk wine from them, and you have praised the gods of silver and gold and bronze and iron, wood and stone, which do not see or hear or know. This next phrase is powerful. And the God who holds your breath in his hand and owns all your ways, you have not glorified. Isn't that a powerful statement? The God who holds your very breath in his hand, you've not glorified him. Then the fingers of the hand were sent from God, verse 24, and the writing was written, and this is the inscription that is written, Mene, Mene, Tikel, Upharsin. This is the interpretation of each word, Mene, God has numbered your kingdom and finished it. You've been weighed in the balances, Tikel, you've been weighed in the balances and you're wanting. Perez, your kingdom has been divided and given to the Medes and the Persians. Basically, the message is, your time is up. He underestimated God's strength when he brought in those vessels and said, God, we don't care what you say. We're going to do what we want to do. Lesson number three, we need to listen to his voice. He says right there in the text, he says, verse 22, you have not humbled yourself, although you knew all of this. We need to be people who listen to his voice. This is where Babylon got into trouble. Listen to his voice. And lastly, listen to this. Don't mess with his stuff. Don't mess with his stuff. When they brought God's stuff in and started messing with it, God had an answer for them. Don't mess with his stuff. Now, I understand how precious and sanctified and special those objects of gold and silver were and so forth. But you know what? The one thing that he has stamped his very own image on are people that you walk with and live with and around. We need to, I think it bears a bit of saying that we need to be careful how we treat people. That doesn't mean that we excuse their sin. That doesn't mean we can't stand up for ourselves and be assertive. But in some level, we need to respect and honor people because they bear the stamp of God's image. And then the things that are his, what is due, rightfully his, what of ours is his, our possessions are his, our time is his. We just make sure we don't miss his stuff, mess with his stuff. Verse 29. Then Belshazzar gave the command, and they clothed David with purple and put a gold chain around his neck and made a proclamation concerning that he should be the third ruler in the kingdom. This is the most hollow promotion anyone ever got. You know why? It was like, here, we're going to give you the keys to the bank vault. And by the way, by morning, the bank is going to be bankrupt. That's basically what he's given. Verse 30, that very night, Belshazzar, king of the Chaldeans, was slain. And Darius the Mede received the kingdom, being about 62 years old. Now, that's all the biblical history tells us. Herodotus tells us that this is what happened that night. The Persians figured out that the only way into the city was through where the water of the Euphrates River flowed under the wall. And it's kind of sketchy how they did this, but he had his engineers start plotting and planning. And upriver of the Euphrates, they had a great work project, probably fueled by forced labor of the Babylonians that they'd captured outside of the city. But they began diverting the water of the Euphrates River. There's actually two different versions of the story. One story says that the water got so low that they walked in on dry ground. Another version says that the water got to mid-thigh level and they marched in wading in the water. But whichever version is correct, they marched under the wall of the city, right into the heart of the city, without breaking down a wall, without firing a shot, so to speak. What was going on inside the city was this big feast, this big festival, and apparently it was not just the people of the select thousand at Belshazzar's palace that was having a party. It was a citywide festival. Most of the guards, most of the soldiers were drunk and intoxicated, and basically they marched in, took over the city without even destroying it. They found the king, execute him, and suddenly when the dawn breaks the next morning, the city of Babylon is part of the Persian, Medo-Persian Empire. And the kingdom of Babylon is no more. Eventually, the city is destroyed and sacked. Basically, later the Arabs come in and take over that part of the world, bring Islam and the Muslim religion in, and everything has changed over the interceding years. But nonetheless, they were destroyed. Don't overestimate your own strength. Underestimate God's. Listen to his voice. Don't mess with his stuff. Here's the conclusion. Here's the conclusion of the lesson of the city of Babylon. It's simply this. We need to make sure in every day, in every way, that we honor God for His strength. We honor God for His strength. Let me give you a suggestion how maybe we can do that. I would just encourage you to try this sometime. Sometime when you're praying, do two things. You can do two things at once. I know you can do it. But praise God for who He is. At the same time, confess who you are. And maybe if Belshazzar had contrasted who he was with who God is, maybe he wouldn't have gotten the mess he was in. Maybe Nebuchadnezzar wouldn't have had to spend seven times living like an animal and the dew falling on his head and all the rest. And what I mean by that is, whatever you praise God for, confess the reality about you. Lord, you're a God of almighty strength. Lord, I recognize that I'm a person of very limited strength. Lord, I praise you that you're a God that is of infinite wisdom. And Lord, I confess to you, I'm a person that really needs your wisdom because I don't have much of my own. Lord, you're a God that is eternal. I am finite. You are holy. I still have even though forgiven and redeemed, yes, I still have the scars of sin on me and a nature that pulls me towards sin. Lord, you're a God of infinite love. Lord, I confess to you, I still have trouble loving some people. You see what that does? It, first of all, lifts God up in praise, but it also sets us up in a proper relation and puts some perspective into our lives. So I'm going to challenge you to try that sometime. Maybe even do it for tonight. Maybe just one or two or three things. Lord, you are. Lord, I am. Because that's one very simple way that you and I can honor God for His strength.